Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, anthropologist Jason De Leon has spent years documenting the stories of migrants making their way across the Sonoran Desert and the southern U.S. border. But for a long time, he felt he was missing part of the story, the smugglers, or as De Leon writes, the most despised in the migration process. We'll find out what he learned from embedding with smugglers over the course of 7 years, how they came to the role, how they could be victims themselves of poverty and violence, and why he thinks portrayals of smugglers as bad guys who prey on the innocent is too simplistic. De Leon's new book is called Soldiers and Kings. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Who are the human smugglers? How does it feel to be responsible for providing life-saving passage while also being implicated in or directly responsible for the many forms of violence that migrants experience? Those are some of the questions that propelled anthropologist Jason De Leon to follow smugglers for 7 years as they moved migrants across Central America and Mexico. We have long been taught that smugglers are the villains in the global migration story, he writes in his new book, Soldiers and Kings. But the story is never black and white. For De Leon, while there are thieves, traffickers, even murderers and rapists among the smugglers, those are the ones he avoided. He was interested instead in people like Roberto, who, quote, defied the stereotypes so often found in Western media portrayals. Jason De Leon is an anthropology professor at UCLA, director of the Kotzen Institute of Archaeology, and head of the Undocumented Migration Project. Welcome to Forum, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little more about Roberto. He was a skinny, banged-up Honduran kid, as you describe him. How did he live?
You know, he lived super rough. He was a kid that I met on the train tracks in southern Mexico in a town called Pacalna in Chiapas. And he was someone who was getting paid very little money. You know, actually, if you factor it out, probably less than minimum wage for smuggling people through Mexico, and was trying to get out too. You know, he was a kind of ex-gangbanger, drug addict, had come from poverty and violence and had sort of fallen into smuggling, you know, providing the service to down and out migrants. But he himself was very much a down and out migrant who was also struggling to walk away from the lifestyle, which was quite difficult for most people.
How did he learn to guide people along those train tracks through really difficult terrain?
I think what a lot of people don't understand about migration is that it can be very long. I mean, I think the idea that many have is that undocumented migration takes 5 minutes. You cross the U.S.-Mexico border and suddenly you are undocumented. But for many folks, especially those coming from central Mexico and farther south, the migration process can be weeks, months, and sometimes even years. And so someone like Roberto and many other young guides that I worked with had tried to cross Mexico many times, had tried to cross the U.S.-Mexico border many times, sometimes successful, then deported, or oftentimes failing numerous times. But during the course of those trips, they learn a lot about how to avoid law enforcement, how to hide in the jungle, how to change your accent so that you sound Mexican. And so many failed migrants transition to becoming smugglers.
And he preferred to call himself a guía or a guide.
Yeah, most of the folks that I worked with would distinguish between a coyote, which is, I think, a more common term that people hear, especially in Mexico, as a smuggler, euphemism for a smuggler, versus a guide. And for many of these folks, the distinction was the guide was the person who did all the dirty work. The guide is a person who walks with you on the train tracks, who gets you through the desert, whereas the coyote oftentimes nowadays is the person who arranges the whole thing, who's making the most money, who's brokering the deal, and then sort of subcontracting these low-level workers.
And you explained that he was not a trafficker. Can you just explain the difference between a trafficker and a smuggler?
This is a huge problem, I think, that people have, is they conflate those things. And, you know, we just have to keep in mind that someone who is trafficked has that happen against their will. Someone who is smuggled is typically paying a smuggler, has sought that person out, given them money and said, please get me to, you know, to my final destination. That does not mean that you can't contract a smuggler who then turns out to be a trafficker and sort of betrays their client. But, you know, there's a clear distinction between those two occupations.
You got pretty close to Roberto. He confides in you that he wants out of the smuggling game. What happened to him?
He tried to get out. He spent, you know, he had tried to get out multiple times. And in the end, you know, really tried to walk away, had fallen in love, decided that he and his partner were going to start a new life. But what many folks realize is that once you're kind of in, you know, and part of the problem is that transnational gangs have really taken over the smuggling industry, sort of in cahoots with drug cartels. And once you're in that lifestyle, it's really hard to get away. And those who leave a gang, who leave smuggling behind, what they oftentimes lose is the protection that comes with being associated with one of those gangs. And so Roberto, unfortunately, you know, tried to leave, tried to find a different pathway. And as soon as he lost the protection that was afforded him while being in a gang, you know, he was murdered. Murdered by someone I knew and someone who I had previously been interviewing.
Yeah, wow. We're getting a rare look into the world of human smugglers with Jason De Leon, who's written a new book called Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. Roberto, he thought of himself as someone that you follow, who can lead you through danger, guide you past immigration agents, get you to where you need to go. But not all the smugglers were like Roberto. And for your own safety, you avoided those who gave off a bad vibe, as you say. So what do you think is important for people to understand about the people you encountered and the boundaries of the experience that you're able to share about this world?
Yeah, you know, working with smugglers of all different ages and backgrounds, I encountered people with radically different kind of perspectives on the job. Some of them saw it as a thing they were just sort of doing to make ends meet for a little bit, and then they were going to walk away. Some of them saw smuggling as an alternative to the murdering that they were doing and the other violent acts that they were doing in association with gangs. And they saw smuggling as, in some ways, a form of redemption. It was allowing them to kind of make amends for the bad stuff that they were doing at other times. And, you know, I ended up working with a lot of guys who were in gangs, who were doing sort of bad stuff on the streets or who had been doing very bad things and were trying to move away from that. The difference being there were other folks who I was kind of, I would encounter, I was kind of working with a little bit, who it was clear that they did not see smuggling as a way to do some good or to provide a service for a client. They saw smuggling as just another way in which they could rob, assault people. And so there was this kind of this distinction between a lot of folks who were doing what we would consider to be very violent sorts of things, but some of them were simultaneously trying to find a different way out. And so I had to kind of figure out, okay, who can I trust that is maybe moving towards something that we would consider to be more admirable, in this case, providing a service to a client, versus someone who's just doing it for the money. And really, at the end of the day, the goal is to brutalize, you know, those folks. And that was a tricky thing that took me many years to figure out how to navigate.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard the horror stories, of course, the ones that really make the headlines, of people leaving migrants to suffocate or die in other situations like that. You talk about how it took you years to kind of think about how to navigate all of that. How did you move through that process? Where did you land?
Well, you know, Roberto's death was one thing that, you know, it happened early on in the field work, and it really, you know, sent me into a tailspin. It made me question everything that I was doing in my life. It made me question whether or not I should be doing research on this subject. at the same time, you know, he was someone who wanted to have his story told. He was someone who I had promised I would try to tell his story. And so his death sort of brought me into this world that I had really no intention of writing about. And doing that, I made this decision very early on. I told myself that I had no business writing about smugglers unless I could find something human about and something relatable about their existence. Because I could write a book about the horrible things that smugglers do from my office without having to do any kind of research. But that's not the full story. And so I went into it trying to be as open-minded as I could as an anthropologist, despite the fact that, you know, I bring my own morals, my own ethics, and my own understandings about issues of right and wrong. But the whole project, I think, forced me to take, I learned a lot about myself during this whole process. Like, why was I there? How was I navigating this stuff? And, you know, these folks taught me a lot about the difficult choices that people have to make. And in a lot of ways too, for me, it was a lesson in empathy, both for the people that I was trying to write about, who many of whom I really felt for and were stuck between a rock and a hard place. But also they were folks who were showing me that they were trying to, you know, do the quote unquote right thing. But they were coming from such difficult circumstances where, you know, it was hard to know what the right thing was in many of those instances for them.
Before you did this, you were working for several years walking with migrants as well. And I imagine the ones who encountered a smuggler like Roberto, you know, were one of the lucky ones. Can you just remind us of the incredibly vulnerable position migrants are in when they put their finances and fate in the hands of a smuggler?
I mean, they are some of the most desperate people you're going to encounter, because they need to get someplace. They're literally running for their lives. They're running for their families' lives, and they are trying to avoid, you know, law enforcement. They're trying to oftentimes run these brutal gauntlets, whether it's the Sonoran Desert of Arizona or the jungles of southern Mexico. And so they're looking for someone to help them, and it's you know, it's a challenge to figure out who to trust, who not to trust. I mean, smuggling is a world where you can't really trust anybody. And yet it still functions enough. I mean, and this is the thing I think people need to realize, is that smugglers obviously do lots of horrific things, leaving people in the desert, leaving them in the back of semi-trucks to suffocate to death. But enough of them provide a service. Enough of them get people across a border that the system keeps working. And so they're providing this service, but it's this kind of, you can think about it in terms of negative reciprocity, where a migrant has contracted someone, says, I'm going to give you $10,000, $15,000 to get me from Honduras all the way to, you know, to Iowa. And the goal is that I'm going to get there. But along the way, that person might be asking for more money. You know, the hope is that you're just going to get fleeced a little bit, but still get there. The worst case scenario is that you're not going to make it to your final destination.
Yeah. Anthropologist Jason De Leon, embedded with a group of smugglers over the course of 7 years. What questions do you have for Jason? How he conducted his research? How a smuggling operation works? What are your reactions to what you're hearing? The email address is forum@kqed.org. The phone number, 866-733-6786. Our social channels are @KQEDForum. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In his book, Soldiers and Kings, UCLA professor of anthropology and Chicano and Central American studies and director of the Kotzen Institute of Archaeology, Jason De Leon, attempted to walk in the shoes of those who are the most despised in the migration process, the smugglers. We're finding out what he learned and hearing from you, our listeners. What questions do you have for Jason about his research? Do you have a personal story about migrating across the southern border? You can email forum@kqed.org. You can post on X, Instagram, or our digital community on Discord. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. And Jason Chris writes, I'm curious to know more about the ecosystem of smugglers and rings. Is it dangerous for an independent smuggler or guide to set out on their own? What portion of smugglers perform their work for less exploitative reasons? Certainly Roberto was independent, but yeah, is it dangerous? And what portion, if you can make that assessment, work for less exploitative reasons, would you say?
Question, because previously, smuggling was kind of mom and pop. I mean, you just had these kind of low-level independent operators who were moving folks around and, you know, they were able to kind of grease some wheels when they needed to, but it wasn't a very formalized kind of system. And now you really can't be independent. You have to have some kind of gang affiliation. You have to have some kind of connection or be able to be in dialogue with those folks, which often this is what attracts, you know, ex-gang members, you know, street kids, because they already are in kind of this violent world, which is now, you know, completely incorporated into the world of smuggling. So like the Mexican train tracks where migrants are moving across is completely controlled by gangs like MS-13 and the Bloods. And so if you're moving within those systems independently, you need to know, you need to at least be in conversation with those folks and really be paying all the right people so that you're not going to end up in trouble. Because if you end up trying to operate outside of those systems, that's when people get kidnapped, you know, extorted and murdered. And so you really have to be connected in some way, shape or form now to organize crime.
So talk to me a little bit about the nuts and bolts. Like how do people find a smuggler?
So it'll happen really in kind of two ways. You're either in your home community, let's say you're in Honduras and there's someone in your community, you contact them and you say, hey, I want to go to Houston, Texas, can you arrange this? And so that person will then make some phone calls, someone will come for you, take you, and will typically move you, the person that they contract might get you from Honduras all the way to the US-Mexico border, while they'll hand you off to someone else. That tends to cost a lot more. Most folks will leave Honduras because they have to, because of gang violence, because of, you know, climate change, or they have to leave in the middle of the night because of super hurricanes, these sorts of things. They may end up in southern Mexico with no guide, and they'll meet someone on the train tracks who says, I can get you 200 kilometers north for a couple hundred bucks. And so they'll start to pay folks sort of piecemeal. And someone like Roberto really just operated within a small home range. So the most he was probably going to get you would be 400 or 500 kilometers and then start this whole thing over. But he might be subcontracted then eventually by someone who says, I need this crew to get me all the way. I need to get this group all the way to the southern Texas border. And so a higher up will kind of pay him to act as, you know, what we would call a soldier. But it, you know, but a lot of folks don't have enough money to pay for the entire trip across Mexico. So they'll pay a couple hundred bucks, they get a couple hundred kilometers north, and then they'll be stuck someplace for several weeks, try to earn some money, call a family member to send some money for the next payday, and then find a new person to get them the next part of the journey north.
You profile a smuggler named Kingston. Roberto was a low-level smuggler. Who was Kingston by comparison?
Kingston was what I would consider to be a mid-level smuggler, so someone who was overseeing crews of younger people, and he would be the kind of person who you would contract from Honduras all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border, and so he would move that group 2,000 kilometers. But he's likely taking orders from someone in Honduras or someone in New York who is kind of overseeing the deal. But you know, he would have several young people like Roberto underneath him, who he would be then paying from whatever it is that he was making. But he was someone who was, you know, in it, relatively old for smuggling, so in his mid-30s, which most folks don't make it that long. They either get arrested, they try to leave the game, or they end up dead. But he was someone who had been doing it for a long time, in his 30s, was deeply gang affiliated, had been in and out of prison in the United States, and had really found smuggling to be the most lucrative thing that he could do, and also an alternative to the more violent things that he was involved with in his gang.
Let me go to caller Greg in Palo Alto. Greg, you're on.
Hi, Nina and Jason. I really am interested in trust. You talked about how you chose someone particularly, but maybe a little more detail, how you got him to trust you, and before that, how you trusted him. Did you have some tests you put him to, or something that gave you sense that he wasn't going to be one of them, the ones that would make you a victim, sure, but would actually allow you to go along?
Greg, thanks. Especially in the context of Kingston, too, who sounds like a very tough person.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, this is one of the things, I think the benefit of anthropology is that I have a lot of time to dedicate towards this stuff. And so, you know, I spent years with these folks. And one of the things that I like to talk about with my students when you're doing what we call ethnographic fieldwork, so you're being immersed in a cultural environment, you're observing, sometimes you're participating in things. The first time you go and you're telling people what you do, they kind of understand it, maybe they're a little suspicious. You're there for a month, you're there for 2 months, however long. But then when you come back after that, something oftentimes really changes. People go, oh, this person's really in it for the long haul. You know, they weren't lying when they said they were gonna come back and really kind of be dedicated to this. And for me in the beginning, it was just the way to trust actually developed really quickly with a lot of these folks. And I think part of it is because they themselves are very good judges of character. You have to be. If you are a smuggler, you're dealing with all kinds of shady people all the time, and you have to be smart about who to trust, who not to trust. And so they can kind of tell when you're not being truthful with them. And so for me, coming into this thing very early on and saying, I'm here, I really want to understand, I'm not a cop, I'm trying to write about your experiences, and I'm trying to be as non-judgmental as I possibly can. I think people really, the smugglers I work with really understood that and respected that. And then the flip side of it was I had to figure out, okay, can I trust this person? Can I trust that person? And with someone like Kingston, I mean, he scared me a lot. And in the book, I write about these moments where there's tension between us and then we end up kind of breaking up because it just gets too much. But in the beginning, I really, you know, I liked him. I liked being around him. I found him interesting. I think he found me sort of interesting as well as his like chronicler. But the thing that always happens for me and this is why I love my job, you know, doing ethnography means engaging with strangers, people from radically different backgrounds than my own. And so I come into this thing saying, I'm asking a lot of you. I'm asking you to let me record our conversations. I'm asking you to let me photograph things. I'm asking you to tell me all about your life. And so for me to get those things from you, I have to give that back as well. And so I had to put a lot of trust into people really early on that things were going to be okay. But I like that. And I think that, you know, I'm also, I would hope, a good judge of character and someone who tries to give as much as myself to the people I work with as they give to me so that we can create this relationship of trust.
Yeah, I will say the verbatim dialogue from your conversations with people like Kingston and others were really powerful parts of your book. What does Kingston tell you about how he sets prices and gets payment for smuggling?
You know, there's all these things that will affect how much you're going to pay. I think part of it is how many people are in your group. Are there children in your group? If there's children, you know, that you can't really take them through the jungle, that's harder. You know, if people want to go in the back of trucks or in the trunk of a car, that ends up costing more. So he makes all these kind of assessments based on like how far you want to go, how many in the group, what you're willing to do or not do. And then, you know, that money, typically he'll get wired bits of money for every part of the journey. So maybe if he starts in Honduras and your group is four people, you need a minimum of like $3,000. And so that $3,000 will cover some of his salary, but a lot of expenses and bribes that have to be paid to get to, you know, let's say Mexico City. And once you're in Mexico City, you start the whole thing again, another round of cash. But if you get arrested in southern Mexico and get sent back to Honduras, you've got to start over. And depending on the deal, he might have said, we're going to give you three chances, and then you got to pay another $3,000. So it can really vary. And so many things can happen that can affect what a trip ends up costing.
You know, I get that smugglers are victims of poverty. They are vulnerable to violence, and often these forces make them work with gangs. There's also much broader structural forces that we can get to later in the conversation. But I guess the piece of this that I really have a hard time with is just extracting as much as possible from really desperate people, like exploiting that desperation to the nth degree. Like, that doesn't have to be standard practice, right?
It shouldn't. But in a lot of ways, you know, it sort of feels like the capitalist system that's exploiting those migrants to begin with. I mean, it's almost like, you know, they're like, undocumented migration has its own form of capitalism that's very similar to the exploitation that those migrants themselves then experience once they, you know, arrive in a place like the United States. But, you know, the corruption and the extortion that happens amongst migrants, I don't think everybody, you know, there are some folks who really try to be as honest as they can in that scenario. And I think, you know, and there's folks I write about like Santos, who's another person in the book. He's someone who, you know, wasn't going to try to fleece migrants and just didn't want to be there, but if he agreed to do something, he was going to do it to the best of his ability. And then there were other folks who maybe would say that and then still be like, okay, just kidding. I'm also going to just keep, you know, I got to keep getting as much money out of you as I possibly can. And I think even my own experiences with these smugglers, you kind of see those differences. I mean, there were folks who never asked me for money, and then there were folks who constantly asked me for money and would invent, you know, these catastrophes and then expect me to kind of pay up, even though I knew that I was getting fleeced. And some of those folks were the same people who were saying to me that, oh, I would never do that, right? And so it's, you know, part of it is, I think, you know, kind of person dependent. But at the end of the day, I mean, the whole system of smuggling is completely exploitative, and it's only getting worse.
Why has, you talked about how it used to be mom and pops, it's a $1 billion global industry now. What has caused it to balloon? What are the direct links between immigration policy and this industry ballooning?
I think it's like a sort of three-part system. One, the home countries where people are leaving from are just getting so much worse. Right, we're getting a window into our future with climate change, political violence, corruption, just the growing inequality that's making, you know, places like Honduras completely unlivable. And so those folks, you know, maybe they could have stayed 15 years ago, and now it's just become impossible for them to stay in those places. And then you've got this labor market in the U.S. and elsewhere that really wants cheap labor, wants those migrants to keep coming because it keeps prices low, and it's an exploitable workforce that can be bossed around. And if you mouth off to a boss about the poor conditions, you can be immediately deported. And so there is this, but you can make more doing that, you know, working in a factory or picking fruit in the U.S. than you could in your home country. So that's still pulling people. But in the middle of that is this growing border enforcement industry, where we waste billions of dollars a year on border walls and all this other stuff, which just fuels the smuggling industry, because the labor markets still want migrants. The home countries are still unlivable and increasingly unlivable. But then now, the more we make border security difficult to overcome, the more smugglers are making, the more need you have for smugglers as well. And, you know, I've always said that people say that, you know, we want to be tough on immigration. If we truly in this country wanted to stop undocumented migration, all we would have to do is police the workforce. If we policed the workforce and did not employ people, then people would stop coming, and we would not need to be spending all this money at the U.S.-Mexico border. But the idea is that it's just like, we hate migrants when they're at the border. We're totally fine with letting them die or disappear on a daily basis. And it's like we're saying to them, if you can find a smuggler, or you yourself can get past this gauntlet of death in Arizona and in South Texas and in southern Mexico and get to the United States, once you're here, then we'll ignore you as long as you're working and doing the things that most Americans don't want to do.
Well, this listener tweets, undoubtedly sad and tragic tales, but the conversation is missing the root cause of the illegal immigration wave, which is government corruption. I think you touched on this, especially when you were describing the conditions in Honduras. The listener goes on to say, until that is addressed, it will continue. It reminds me of the tragic irony for Central Americans that you write about, that they're leaving home because of horrific conditions, gang violence, and so on. only to encounter these horrific conditions on the migrant trail, gang violence on the migrant trail. Do you want to share more reflections on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think migrants, they're experiencing brutality everywhere they go. And, you know, this, you could think about it, like the complexity of this is, like, let's think about, government corruption. Well, Honduras is the way that Honduras is because the U.S. has been intervening in Honduran politics for over 100 years. I mean, it's the original banana republic. And so when we talk about, you know, the corruption problems in Honduras or the corruption problems in Mexico, we need to understand that the U.S. is deeply implicated in those things. Corruption in Mexico and Honduras, right, linked to the drug trade and the drug wars. Who's consuming the drugs, right? They're being consumed in the United States. Where are the guns coming from? They're coming from the United States. And so it's, you know, we can't just put the blame on Central America or on Mexico. We have to really understand that this is a binational problem that the U.S. is deeply, deeply implicated in. And then these migrants, I mean, for me, like, the ironies are you have people in Honduras who are fleeing climate change. And Honduras is a country that disproportionately experiences climate change that's being driven by the global north. And so the super hurricanes that are hitting Honduras caused by things that are happening in the United States and elsewhere. And then those folks are being displaced by activities by the United States. Then crossing Mexico and experiencing all this brutality, much of it supported by the United States. So the U.S. is deeply invested in helping Mexico stop Central Americans before they can get to the U.S.-Mexico border. And that is very much an Obama-era program, although it does even precede that. And then so those folks flee climate change, experiences brutality in Mexico, partly supported by the U.S., try to cross into the U.S.-Mexico border through the southern Arizona desert because of policies like prevention through deterrence, which is a U.S. border enforcement policy that purposely funnels people to the desert as a way to use that environment as a weapon against migrants. And then now, in the desert, they're experiencing higher temperatures because of climate change and dying at higher rates than they were even 10 years ago. And so it's a really, you know, it's impossible, I think, to point your finger at one thing. And I think really for this whole story is we need to think about all of these parts as really fitting together. And for me, you can't address immigration or immigration reform without talking about all of those different parts as one unit.
Yeah. Jason De Leon spent most of his career documenting the stories of migrants across the Sonoran Desert, but he felt he was missing an essential part of the story, the world of human smugglers, and he has documented it now after spending 7 years following smugglers. His new book is called Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling, and we'll have more with him and with you, our listeners, right after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Jason De Leon is director of the Kotzen Institute of Archaeology and professor of anthropology in Chicana, Chicano, and Central American Studies at UCLA. You may know him from his previous book, The Land of Open Graves, Living and Dying on the Migrant Trail. His new book is another side of the migration process, The Smugglers. It's called Soldiers and Kings, Survival and Hope in the World of Human Smuggling. And you, our listeners, are sharing your thoughts, also your questions with Jason De Leon about his research, about smuggling operations, about the forces that contribute to this incredibly growing, large, and ballooning, as he says, industry. The email address is forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are @KQED Forum. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Let me go to Christina in Oakland. Christina, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you for having me. I just want to have a question and then a quick anecdote. I helped organize a volunteer-run community water monitoring group, and this group was in Guatemala and basically the volunteers from the community that was next to a mine, and they were using labs to monitor if the mine was causing any impacts. All right, it's a long story to talk about this one member of this volunteer group that was a coyote, and he was very well respected. This was about 10 years ago, so this leads to my question, but the community really respected him. He had a very good job. He would disappear for 6 months, come back. We weren't allowed to ask him questions about what he did or where he was or where he was in, but I know that the community where he was born and raised respected him, and they saw him as someone providing a lifeline to people in Guatemala who were at that time suffering from the gangs, not in the community where I was working, but in the surrounding communities in the country. So my question was a little bit, did you have a chance to go back to the communities where some of these people are from and get a sense of how they were seen? And I'm learning from this discussion that apparently maybe things have changed in the last 10 years. I left that project about 10 years ago, but I wondered, those were a few of my questions, if the communities themselves, how they're seen and how they're viewed.
Christina, thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, things really have changed a lot. You still do have community members who are moving people across Mexico and into the U.S., but the demographic has really shifted. I mean, it is a lot of young people who have these gang affiliations who, the gangs have really kind of cornered the market on smuggling. And in a lot of ways, they've pushed out the mom and pop operators who people found to be more trustworthy, and I think if nothing else, it's just gotten more untrustworthy, if that's even possible, in this scenario where just because people have been pushed out and a whole new demographic has come in. And that was a thing that really surprised me, was I didn't expect to be on the train tracks, and everybody that I was talking to who was smuggling folks was in MS-13 or was a Blood or was, in 18th Street. That's the new labor market for this whole thing, which then radically, of course, changes the experience that people have. It changes the kind of trust dynamics, because I think, as we were saying, how can you trust someone that looks like the person who ran you out of your home village? But people are really forced into that. And I was even surprised to see, 18th Street and MS-13, those gangs do not get along, in Honduras, in LA. But on the train tracks, there was a bit of unity there, because they were all working for the same kind of goal, to make money off of these desperate migrants. And I think migrants themselves were just, really just in a bad place, having to trust these folks who generally most would consider to be completely untrustworthy.
Noel on Discord writes, too many companies want cheap labor, as De Leon says, yet the governor of Texas wants to scapegoat the migrants and use them as political pawns. Maybe he does this to deflect from business interests who want exploitable workers and consumers want low food prices. It's easier to blame the migrants and dehumanize them so we don't care about their fates. And another listener writes, what are the biggest myths about immigration that politicians spread? And of course, this, especially in an election year like we have right now, this becomes such a hot button issue, to use an overly used phrase. I want to ask you about your experience talking with the other side, with border police. You actually managed to get an interview with agents with this organization, GOET, Grupo de Operaciones Especiales Tácticas, I think is how you say it. It's a Honduran police force, but funded by the U.S. government. Can you talk about what their mission is?
So, GOET is is kind of a super police force in Honduras that I was introduced to through the Border Patrol. I had connected with high-ranking members of Customs and Border Protection many years ago, who wanted me to start to I wanted to write kind of a dual narrative, like the smuggling side and then the Border Patrol side. And so I started getting connected with Border Patrol agents in Mexico, you know, because we have agents who are in Mexico City and elsewhere. I was working with agents who were in Arizona, and all of those folks kept telling me, you need to meet the GOET team, which is this special tactic team in Honduras that the U.S. was training, you know, training on U.S. soil, providing them with equipment and technology and all that kind of stuff, and literally training a Honduran force to keep Hondurans from leaving their country. So these are people, you know, they're policing the northern border of Honduras, and they're trying to catch unaccompanied minors. They're trying to catch single parents with their children, because you need to have either both parents present or a letter from a judge to cross a border without a second parent. And then, of course, people coming from other parts of the world. But, you know, I had some pretty striking conversations with GOET members facilitated by the Border Patrol in Honduras who were saying things to me like, our country is terrible. Things are going really bad for a lot of the young people. They're literally running from their lives. They're going to get killed in the colonias where they're from, and we are catching them and sending them back. And we're catching them and sending them back because it's one, you know, it's illegal to leave the country if you're a minor. But two, we're doing it because your government, the United States, what they're telling me, is asking us to and helping us to keep our own citizens in this place, which for me, you know, when someone says to me, these folks are running from their lives and they can die, and I know that if we send them back, that they could potentially be killed, but we're doing it anyway, and we're doing it with the help of, you know, of your government. That was a really, really eye-opening conversation for me.
And how did they reconcile that? I mean, I know they explained the forces that pushed them to do it, but how did some of these people that you interviewed reconcile that?
They reconcile it the same way that the U.S. Border Patrol does. You know, the majority of Border Patrol agents are Latinx. And, you know, many of them are immigrants or the children of immigrants. And what they will say is that, you know, I'm doing my job, that these new immigrants are breaking the law, and law is the law, and that's what we're going to do. And that's the same thing that a lot of these agents in Honduras were telling me. They're like, we know it's not easy. We know these people are really suffering. But what can we do? We are following the letter of the law, you know, which gets you into this conversation about, you know, people oftentimes want to put legality in front of humanity. And, you know, in this current political moment, we're seeing that, as one of the listeners said, that, you know, we're using migrants as pawns and we're blaming them for everything. And I think we need to take stock about what immigrants do in this country. I think we need to take stock about the fairness of laws that are currently in place. And I think educate ourselves about the fact that thousands of people have died crossing the U.S.-Mexico border since the mid-90s, and people die on a daily basis. And yet we don't hear anything about it because it happens, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. When we do hear about it, people are often dismissive of it because they just say, well, the law is the law. And, you know, so I think that's how a lot of people justify this whole experience, or this you know, cognitive dissonance. How do I catch someone who looks just like me, or who comes from a similar situation like me, and then be okay with sending them back?
You had intended to tell more of the U.S. Border Patrol side of the story, but what happened?
You know, I was making, I think, good inroads with a lot of these agents right before Trump was elected, and people really wanted to talk to me about what it was like to be a Border Patrol agent, the kind of complexities of the job. You know, they had lots of questions about smugglers and vice versa. Smugglers always asked me about the Border Patrol. Mm. Border Patrol always asked me about what smugglers were like. But, you know, as soon as Trump came in, you know, many of the agents that I was working with sort of had to shut down communications for various reasons. And then, you know, I think people were sort of hopeful towards the end of the Obama era that we were on the cusp of some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. And as soon as Trump came in, of course, that went out the door. And so did, and many of the doors that I had that had been open for me and lines of communication ended up being closed.
Hmm. Let me go to caller Rob in San Francisco. Rob, you're on.
Thank you. Fascinating topic. A couple of thoughts and then a question. The thoughts are, one is that it seems like collectively American companies have been able to hold down the cost of goods and services and keep inflation low in the last 30 years simply from illegal immigration, because like your guest said, they know they can pay people less because they're not going to complain. Another thought is it's kind of destroyed the job market for teenagers because a lot of immigrants are working cheap. And that used to be where, you know, teenagers might get their first job in a McDonald's or working construction during the summer. All those jobs don't seem to be, it seems like mostly immigrants are taking those jobs now. And my third thing is the question, which is, do you see this ever being solved? Because every time they try in Washington, you know, the industry people probably rush in and do their campaign contributions and lean on the senators to say, don't fix this. We like it just the way it is. So,
oh, sorry, Rob, I think we lost you there for a second, but I think we got the gist of what you were saying. Your reaction to what Rob was saying there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a heavy investment in keeping this system going because, of course, the industries make lots of money off of immigrant labor. Immigrants in this country pay taxes and put into the system in all kinds of ways and oftentimes don't take anything out of that. And so many of them are paying income tax and they're definitely paying sales taxes, other things that they don't ever really get to draw from. So the system works for a lot of people. And then also think about the border security industrial complex, the migrant detention industrial complex. Those are huge industries that make a whole lot of money policing the border and incarcerating people. And so I think there are lots of lobbyists who are deeply invested in keeping those systems going. You know, and this question too about you know the types of jobs that migrants are taking. Yeah, I mean I think in some industries maybe that is a case that there is some competition, you know, construction potentially being one of them. But you know, if you look at like the agricultural industry, you know, when Alabama passed, I think it was SB 1018, I don't remember now, but when they passed a law basically saying that they were going to crack down on immigrant farm labor, they couldn't keep an American for more than a week doing any of those jobs and had to immediately, you know, repeal that law so that they could bring those folks back out there. So, you know, I think that there are perhaps in some instances, there are some industries where they're competing more directly with perhaps, you know, young people. But I think a lot of these industries, there's, you know, you're not going to find an American citizen within 100 yards. And something else to keep in mind, too, you know, I think that the working class folks in the U.S. are often pitted against immigrants. And we're seeing that happen now. And we're going to see that happen through the end of the year into this election cycle. But they're pitted against immigrants in kind of false ways. I mean, I remember in 2016, I went to a Trump rally in Warren, Michigan. And, you know, Trump comes out, and before he even comes out, people are chanting, build a wall and all this kind of stuff. And he comes out and tells a room full of auto workers or ex-auto workers, he says, you know, we're going to build this big giant wall to keep all the Mexicans out and keep them from stealing your jobs. And people were applauding and cheering. And there was this thing as if the immigrants who were coming here, the migrants who were coming to the United States, were somehow responsible for the outsourcing of these automotive jobs and completely missing the fact that the industries control where those jobs go. And they're the ones who decide, you know, to build a plant in Brazil or in Mexico. And I think that, you know, people need to think about that and really question what it is, you know, that we think migrants or immigrants are actually doing in this country. And if we take a step back and look at the bigger picture, you know, the working class are all, you know, pawns in this much bigger economic system.
We're talking with Jason De Leon, and let me remind you, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Well, Jesse writes, I think that mortality and its associated desperations play an important role in the smugglers' own behaviors, including their excesses of greed and deceit. When people, especially young people in their 20s, can't realistically imagine a long life for themselves, why not go for broke to make as much money as quickly as they can? Rob was asking about, can this ever be resolved? I guess more specifically, just in terms of cracking down on the worst aspects of human smuggling, you've called that extremely difficult to do. You've called human smuggling and migration a beast with many heads. But your thoughts on that?
I think it's an impossible thing to stop, much like migration. You cannot stop migration. Build a wall. You know, you can put landmines, whatever you want to do. I mean, in 1994, the U.S. thought that if they started funneling migrants towards the Sonoran Desert of Arizona, that people would die, and if enough people died, that migrants would know that it was too dangerous and they would stop coming. And that's not my liberal bias. I mean, I wrote about this as the kind of the core of my first book, is really showing the U.S. government was purposely doing these things, thinking that a few migrant deaths would slow this whole process down. Clearly, that's not been the case. I mean, people understand that it's dangerous. They understand that they can die, and yet they're going to continue to migrate. And they'll tell you that they would rather die in the Arizona desert than die on a street corner in Honduras because someone shoots them. Because at least in the Arizona desert, they've taken some control of their life, and there's a possibility of getting through and some hope. And so with that being said, it just tells you that you can't do anything to stop that the history of our species, you know, this is me as the anthropologist now, like, our species has thrived from the beginning because of our ability to migrate and to seek out new resources. And that's all we're seeing happen now. And so trying to stop that is like, you know, it's like trying to stop human evolution. It is an impossibility. And so with that being said, as long as people are desperate to go to some new, safer place, and there are people trying to stop them from doing that, you are going to find smugglers there willing to make some money off of that desperation. And so it's, you know, you arrest people, it's not going to do anything, you know, crack down, put them in prison. It's not going to have any major effect on this system at all.
What is your broader goal for shining a light on the smuggling world, on smugglers, getting to know them intimately? What effect are you hoping it'll have?
I'm hoping to complicate the narrative around migration, because I think we need new kinds of conversations about this whole thing. I think we need to stop thinking about it in these sort of simplistic black and white terms. I think we need to understand the more complicated system that actually exists. And if we can understand the different parts of it, then maybe we can begin to figure out how to deal with it in a more realistic kind of way. But I would also say, you know, for me, that this project, it ended up being about empathy too. Like, could I use anthropology to understand someone from such a radically different background than my own, and be able to find something human in even such a dark and brutal place?
And the answer is yes, right, for you?
I mean, it has changed my life, and I think I had to do a lot of soul searching, and I think I never thought that spending 7 years with smugglers would somehow make me a better person, but I do feel like that has been the case. It's really impacted me and made me appreciate things in different ways and helped me, I think, to be more empathetic in general.
Jason, thank you for coming on. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.